With me now on Fresh Air is filmmaker and writer Kenneth Anger, who's acknowledged as being one of the first important independent filmmakers in America, and whose film Scorpio Rising is probably one of the most frequently shown and talked about independent films. Scorpio Rising shows biker culture in all its paraphernalia, tight pants, leather jackets, chains, leather boots, in a homoerotic context. The biker sequences are intercut with scenes of Jesus Christ, which Anger says is footage from a film called The Road to Jerusalem, which was delivered to his home by mistake while he was making Scorpio. On the soundtrack, rock and roll hits of the early 60s are ironically juxtaposed with the images, songs like I Will Follow Him, He's a Rebel, and Torture. For the past 10 years, Anger's been working on a trilogy. The first film, Lucifer Rising, has just been completed. It's inspired by the writing of British occultist Aleister Crowley, who saw Lucifer as being the spiritual center of the universe. Lucifer Rising is a film of occult imagery, with Anger playing a magus, singer Marianne Faithfull playing Lilith, and others cast as Isis and Osiris. Anger says that this project is becoming one of the more expensive independent films ever financed independently. To continue to fund it, he says he recently sold his Nazi memorabilia collection to Keith Richards, who you may know from the Rolling Stones. If you haven't seen any of Anger's films, perhaps you're familiar with his book Hollywood Babylon, a highly illustrated collection of some of Hollywood's most garish and exotic dreams and stories of actors and actresses at their most desperate and disheveled moments. The book is subtitled The Legendary Underground Classic of Hollywood's Darkest and Best-Kept Secrets. Even Hollywood Babylon has a quote from Aleister Crowley. The quote is, "Every man and every woman is a star." Well, Kenneth Anger is in Philadelphia for a screening of his films tomorrow evening at the Moore College of Art. And I know I said earlier that it was tonight, so I was wrong. I'm a little confused as to my days. The screening is tomorrow night at the Moore College of Art, which is at 20th and the Parkway, and the screening begins at 8 o'clock. And if you'd like any more information, you can call the Moore College at 568-4515. Kenneth Anger, it's a great pleasure to meet you. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Happy to be here.
Since you've been spending a number of years collecting images for Lucifer Rising, which has just been completed and will be showing tomorrow night, can you give us an overall introduction to what you're doing with that film?
It's my quest for Lucifer, looking for Lucifer. And Lucifer isn't the devil in the Christian sense. According to Aleister Crowley, he's the spirit of light. So I see him actually as the patron saint of movies. He's the light inside the projector. And I've been particularly interested in tracking down all the sites that were sacred to Lucifer in the ancient world. In other words, which were basically places of sun worship. I've been to Stonehenge, I've been to the pyramids, I've been to a place called Externstein in Germany, and I've filmed in all those places.
I guess that's part of the reason why it's become so expensive. To shoot on location like that on an independent budget is a difficult thing to do, I'd imagine.
Well, I took six people to Egypt, for instance.
Not that cheap.
Right.
So how did you get introduced to Aleister Crowley's work?
I knew his godson in California. Crowley died in 1947, so I was unable to meet him. He was an Englishman who at one time had been qualified by Lord Beaverbrook as the wickedest man in the world. Of course, Lord Beaverbrook was running a very yellow tabloid paper called the Express in England. And he sold a lot of newspapers on Aleister Crowley's notoriety. But I've been fascinated by Crowley. I think he's largely misunderstood, and I've set about collecting his written works and unpublished manuscripts, and I have quite a good collection.
When you say misunderstood, you mean misunderstood as someone who started a devil worship cult?
Well, he was a pagan, and I consider myself a pagan, too.
Yeah, what does pagan mean?
Pagan is basically nature worship, the sun, the moon, the stars, and the earth. Men and women seen as, in their spiritual sense, as gods and goddesses.
I think some people see pagan religions as being a way of undermining other religions, but that's not what you're about.
Well, other religions undermine paganism, and paganism still exists in many parts of the world, and it was basically the religion of the Druids and the Celts, and It still exists. I've seen ceremonies performed for the flourishing crops, things like that, in many parts of the world. Like, it's very closely tied in with nature.
Do you? Are there any rituals that you participate in?
I've performed what's known as the ceremony of the equinox, which is a very pleasant way to see out summer and see in the fall, or see out see in the spring.
I saw your films at the Whitney on, I guess it was the day of the winter solstice, and you showed up to say hello to everyone who had come to see the films and remarked that this was a very special day for you, it being the solstice.
Yes, the solstice and the equinoxes are both the summer and winter solstice. Being the shortest day of winter, the longest day of summer, are important festivals.
You started Lucifer Rising, I guess, close to 10 years ago. So much has changed in our culture since then, and I'm thinking, I guess, specifically here of what might be called psychedelic imagery and a kind of mass participation in psychedelic drugs and hallucinogenics, a mass participation in that that certainly isn't really occurring now. Has the imagery in the film or the music in the film or any of the any of your intentions with the film been changed by the changes that have happened in I guess, popular culture of the time?
Well, I myself have changed, and the film reflects that. My original plan was to film it in San Francisco with a group there, and I had my Lucifer proved to be a little bit too demonic, and we had a falling out, and he ended up stealing part of the film, and actually he later went to Southern California and unfortunately met Charles Manson and moved in with him and became part of the Manson so-called family. And his name is Bobby Beausoleil. He's a very talented musician. And later he, because of a jail sentence, not for the Tate killings, but for another killing, he's now serving a life sentence. And I was able to commission him to do the music for Lucifer Rising in prison, which I think is the only time that's ever been done.
Why did you still want to maintain an artistic connection with him?
Because he's extremely talented. And he's a remarkable person. He's a remarkable person who made an unfortunate mistake.
So, and you're using the music that he wrote for that?
Yes, it's excellent music. And I provided the prison with the stereo tape recorder to record it.
Is this the kind of problem that you sometimes run into when you're dealing with some... I don't know if your interest in Crowley had anything to do with this or not, but when you're working directly with the ideas or with allusions to the imagery created by someone like Crowley, do you get people who are, I guess, a little nuts or violent, dangerous?
Well, encounters with this kind of person can occur in every walk of life, and I certainly haven't sought them out on purpose. And I have met a few, true, but actually, the ones that I met are in no way disciples of Crowley. In fact, the worst ones have never cracked a book. They're not readers.
Right.
So it's just a coincidence that some of them have been prone to violence.
Well, tell us how you wanted the people playing Isis and Osiris and Lilith to be dressed in the movie.
I modeled the costumes after tomb paintings of ancient Egypt, and I wanted to get away from the Hollywood look of ancient Egypt, because films such as Liz Taylor as Cleopatra have much more to do with Beverly Hills than they do with, or Miami Beach, than with the way ancient Egypt looked. I mean, ancient Egypt was quite muted and understated. And in the costumes and the coloring and everything, they certainly didn't have any lame. And they had gold, but they didn't have lame.
I grew up with these great fantasies of ancient Egypt from the earlier movies. All the religious epics also.
Yes. Well, I typecast to some extent the people in my film. For instance, I chose Donald Cammell, the director of performance, to play Osiris. And his girlfriend happens to be an Egyptian princess. And so she plays Isis. And
how did she relate to that?
Well, they loved it. They loved doing it. Yes.
Well, how does she see herself as an Egyptian princess?
Well, through reincarnation.
Yes. not through direct lineage.
No.
Okay. And do you believe that too, or is what anyone says they are good enough?
Well, she seemed to remember several past lives, so I'll take her on her authority.
Do you have any connection, do you think, to past lives or of your own?
Well, ancient Egypt seems very familiar to me.
Yeah, you know, you can never tell if it's movies or...
Right.
I mean, when you start flashing back to something, you say,
right.
Gee, maybe this
anyway,
was another life. It might always be an old film you saw.
Could be wishful thinking, but I felt very much at home in Egypt. And
What about sexual imagery in the movie?
Lucifer Rising is mainly concerned with spiritual states. There's some nudity in the film, but there is nothing explicit.
What is there a connection in your thought between sexuality and spirituality? Because I know that among some pagan groups, sexuality plays a very important part of some of the spiritual rituals.
Well, true. I mean, for Crowley, he called it sex magic, and meaning that every person has a powerful potential which can be directed through the use of sexuality. That's part of Crowley's belief.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he would have liked the movie if he saw it?
I hope so. I made it for him. It's dedicated to him. It says it's dedicated to Al, which means Aleister Crowley.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You had said... you said that you sold your Nazi memorabilia to raise some money in order to continue funding your film work and sold it to Keith Richards, who many of us know from the Rolling Stones. What's in the collection?
Well, I had a very unusual album of SS photographs that were private photographs taken by a member of Hitler's bodyguard. And at one time I thought I wanted to use it as the basis of a film, to film these photographs. And Keith Richards has an interest in memorabilia of the Third Reich, so I sold it to Keith.
Do you have a special interest in that?
I happened to pick it up at an auction at Sotheby's some years ago. And I do, because it used and abused magical symbols. And in a sense, it worked as long as it worked. I mean, what the two most recognizable and powerful symbols of the 20th century are the swastika and Mickey Mouse. And one, I suppose, is the most obvious kind of symbol of American good humor. And the use of the swastika by the Nazis was actually a theft of a very ancient solar symbol that was used by, among others, the American Indians and the Hindus. So it's a very ancient symbol, but it's also very powerful. And the symbol isn't sullied by the horrible use it was put to, because it was misused by that group.
I know a lot of people can't disconnect the symbol from what it meant when the Nazis used it. Do you get any hostility?
Well, the symbol is like thousands of years old. It was misused for 12 years. And I figure that in time, it'll assume its dignified place again, among other symbols, such as the cross, the circle, the triangle, and so forth.
What about the other... uniforms and other objects associated with the SS. Did you have any of that?
No. Basically, I have an unusual collection of photographs, which I've sold part of them. But I've had to sell various pieces of my collection of Hollywood memorabilia also to meet lab bills, because I got help on Lucifer Rising from several foundations, the National Endowment for the Arts and the New York State Art Council. But it just eats up money making movies. I mean, it's a very expensive means of expression for an artist, and it's not becoming cheaper.
Let's talk a little bit about your film Scorpio Rising, and why don't you describe? I described it before as being about biker culture and all its paraphernalia, the tight pants and leather jackets and boots, in a very homoerotic light. How would you describe the film and who the people were and what you were trying to do in the way you use them in the movie?
It's slightly mocking. In other words, I'm not really describing it. It's slightly satirical. I mean, that has to be remembered. And my use of musical commentary is also a satirical one. I mean, when I show a biker dressing up in blue jeans and leather jacket and everything, putting on his chains and all that, and the musical commentary to it is "She Wore Blue Velvet." I mean, this is a sort of juxtaposition which before Scorpio Rising had never been done before. So in that way, it's kind of unique.
Right, and this is 1964, right?
Yeah, right.
Who were the men who were used in it?
It was a group of Italians living in Brooklyn, quite a gentle group. And the fact that you just see mainly males in the film, there are a few females, but doesn't mean that they didn't have girlfriends and now that they have wives. But for some peculiar reason, they didn't want their girlfriends photographed. They watched the film being made on the sidelines. And it has something to do with their ethnic background, I think. They didn't want their girlfriends in the picture. So that changed the picture. If the picture had had the girlfriends in, I don't think it would be quite as homoerotic in tone as it seems to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, some anthropologists who I've spoken to recently who have been, like in primitive cultures, the men there also didn't want their wives photographed or maybe even interviewed by...
Yes,
by the anthropologist.
It's an odd attitude.
The film that I just found this out by reading an article about you. I was really amazed. There's all these inserts of Christ imagery in it, and apparently, what that was from a film that was accidentally delivered to you.
I was cutting Scorpio Rising when the postman left a package on my porch, and I thought it was one of my films being returned, so I just accepted it and took it in. And it turned out that it was a Sunday school film, which was delivered to me by mistake. And I ran it on my projector, and then because I was in the midst of cutting Scorpio Rising, I suddenly saw a parallel with what I was doing and the kind of theme of leaders and followers. And it fit right in, at least... You can call it a kind of surrealism if you want, but suddenly I just saw how it fit right in with the theme.
Yeah, it does really work. I guess that was really serendipity that you never would have said, oh, images of Jesus Christ would work really well in this film. You never would have just come up with that had it not been delivered.
Not in the same way. I mean, who knows? It may have been a different... quite a different film.
You would have shot it differently, too, than the Sunday school film producers shot it, right?
Well, the reason I like the Sunday school film is that it's done in a very naive way. They're almost like animated waxworks.
You know, one of the things that was interesting about the behavior of the men in your film is all the preening in it, all the, like, careful combing of the hair and attention to, like, placing the chains properly when they're being put on, behavior that's always called female, right? Because men usually accuse women of being the ones who are very vain and spending 15 minutes combing their hair before getting ready to leave. I found that really interesting.
Well, it's a mistake to think it's female behavior, because grooming is... and male grooming and vanity goes right back to the most primitive cultures, and I've talked to a lot of anthropologists about it. And they say there's tribes in New Guinea and places like that where the men spend most of their time painting their bodies with patterns or putting weaving shells into their hair, things like that. And traditionally, until the sort of Victorian age, I mean, men were very brightly costumed. And of course, that came back in our country in the 60s again, when suddenly people were wearing rainbow colors and things like that.
Right, right. And we're watching them get dressed in the movie, and particularly things like placing the chains with a certain preening and vanity about it. You know, chains, you always think, well, this is a sign of power. Someone wants to communicate power and also the fact that they have a potential weapon. But watching them, I said, and sexuality, that they definitely want to communicate sexuality with that. Did you feel that way?
Well, definitely, almost. I mean, the whole outfit of leather jackets and decorated with chains and things has all those implications. And, of course, everything has ended up being ripped off by fashion. So now it becomes almost a cliche, because things like that have been picked up too much by, they're no longer the exclusive preserve of one group, which, like the bikers, for instance. I've seen leather jackets decorated with chains in boutiques and things like that.
So. What does that say to you?
Nothing. It's just our culture does that endlessly.
Mm-hmm. The two Hollywood-type models that the men seem to have were, I'd say, Brando and James Dean, particularly, maybe. Were they ever influences on you? I don't know where you were at the time when their movies, well, Brando's early movies and James Dean's only movies were out.
Well, there's a reference in my film to The Wild One, Brando's motorcycle movie.
Right.
Actually, there too, it was an extraordinary coincidence, because I was filming in the room late one night of the biker named Scorpio, and the late night movie happened to be The Wild One. It was on the television set, so I included some shots of that on the television.
How did he react to the movie?
Well, he'd seen it before, so I mean, he just, that's the kind of happy coincidence that I always incorporate in my work when I can.
I mean, I'd wonder if he would think that it was a funny movie or a serious movie or a cheap movie or a campy movie.
Well, I think if you see it again today, it's too sentimental for my taste.
I saw it like 2 years ago. It's one of the films that has a little crawl at the beginning saying, this didn't really happen, but on the other hand, it might happen in your town if you're not really careful that a young band of bikers like this can come in and take over. And
well, of course, something similar to that did occur. I mean, they were claiming it didn't, but it did occur in one of the early incidents in the late 40s with the original Hells Angels gang occurred in a small town in California. And that's what the incident was based on.
Could you ever have made a film like Scorpio Rising with Hells Angels?
I don't think so, because they're too paranoid. I talked to some of them, and they were convinced I was some sort of police spy.
Uh-huh.
And so I just couldn't get through to them. But the small group I worked with in Brooklyn, who had no name, they were just a bunch of guys who liked riding bikes and building show bikes, I was able to approach them through photographing their bikes for them. I mean, and they accepted me as a kind of camera nut. I worked completely alone, without any crew. And so I was able to go into their garages and finally into their houses and so forth.
They're all in your film wearing the clothes that speak danger, right? I mean, because leather and chains and all the imagery on the back of their jackets and stuff. I mean, it all says danger, but were they dangerous, or do you think it was an image that they were trying to cultivate? Because you find the groups who are just trying to give an image that they don't really have, using the right symbols to communicate it.
Well, I mean, riding bikes is a motorcycles is a dangerous thing to do. There's a reason for leather jackets, and that is because if you spill, you're going to tear the leather jacket, not tear off your skin. So they're basically protective devices. Yeah. And the chains are something you wrap around the wheel and padlock up when you, so the bike won't get stolen. So that's where the original chains came from.
It's interesting that some of that paraphernalia and imagery has been translated into like S&M paraphernalia. What connections do you think exist?
It's just the obvious connection. I mean, it's sort of male symbols of powers with suggestions of brutality and sort of like dangerous playmates, something like that.
You have, I'm trying to think of the name of the film, The Car Commandos?
Custom Car Commandos.
Yeah. And what year was that made?
That was made in 65.
Yeah, I think it was probably one of the first statements that basically said, gee, cars are really erotic objects in our culture.
Yes, I made that film about the same time as Tom Wolfe did his essay on custom cars. And the statements were rather similar.
What made you decide to become an independent filmmaker? Because you started doing it before it was a familiar thing. There wasn't a big independent or underground film movement.
I began making films with a 16mm home movie camera that was just available to me in my family. And my first actors were my schoolmates. And my set was my house and things like that. And I just wanted to make movies on my own. And I'd been exposed to Hollywood films from working as a child actor. I was in Midsummer Night's Dream as the Changeling Prince. And I saw the possibilities of big studios and everything, but mostly I just wanted to make movies on my own. I was enthralled with the idea of making movies. But I wanted to do it on my own. I didn't want other people telling me what to do. I mean, I've always been extremely independent in every way. And I'd heard all kinds of horror stories from the time I was a child about interference from the front office. I didn't want a front office. And so I've never had one. Which the bad side of that is that it's always been hard rounding up enough money to make my films.
Right. How do you know when you have an idea that is worthy of the amount of time and money it's going to take to see it through?
Well, the idea really takes over. I mean, it sort of call it a muse or whatever you will. It grabs me, and it sort of insists on being made, often to great inconvenience, it seems.
Right. So you were in Hollywood as a child acting, and most of us when we were children, we got to see the finished product, the movie, and it was magic, period. But you got to see the behind-the-scenes stuff, so how much of the magic was there for you when you were a kid in Hollywood?
Well, to me, the machinery of making movies is as magical as anything else. The thing I remember most when I was working at Warner Brothers was the day that the moonbeams caught on fire, because the moonbeams on the set of Midsummer Night Dream were made out of cellophane, and there was a scene in which they were wrapped around an enormous plaster oak tree. And hundreds of little imps ran up the moonbeam. It's a beautiful shot, but this was done by disguising the steps that they ran up with cellophane. And the cellophane had arc lights, very powerful incandescent lights pointed down on it. And some of the lights must have been too close. The cellophane burst into flames. And so all the little kiddies were screaming and running up the moonbeam to keep from getting scorched. I always thought that was very, very magical.
Was it scary?
Thrilling. Nobody got really burned. But I think the idea of moonbeams catching on fire is a nice idea.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Did you see that as being connected with your interest in Crowley also, you know, and like light and astrology? And not astrology, I mean, yeah, astrology.
Well, I was much too young at that time to...
No, I mean, looking back now.
Oh, looking back. Well, perhaps.
You know, we look back on our past and make all these connections,
yes.
Right? What are some of the other images that remain with you from sets or from actors? With Hollywood Babylon, I know that you're interested in a lot of the darker moments of the careers of Hollywood actors and actresses. Did you get to see much of that when you were young? Much of the breakdowns that we always see movies about?
Well, I was the next door neighbor to Lupe Velez in Beverly Hills when she committed suicide. And so I was actually able to see the bedroom where she died. And I was able to talk to the cook, her maid, and the gardener, who all gave me little tidbits about what happened. And in a couple of cases, I was pretty close to what happened. Also, in the case of Thelma Todd's death, she was found dead in her garage. And again, I happened to be living very close to her at that time. And I knew also the sons and daughters of some of the stars who were involved in scandals or tragedies.
What message did that give you about what it was like to be famous or wealthy?
It's just, it isn't so much the wealth, it's the being in the public eye. And it's a stressful situation in many ways.
How much are you in the public eye? Because you're not a star like, say, you know, Jane Mansfield, who's on the cover of Hollywood Babylon. But you have a really loyal following. You have some people who are really interested in your work, and I don't know what kind of entourage you have. You know, like people who just follow you around. But you know, your life to some extent is in the public eye, although it's a smaller public than Hollywood stars have.
Well, I think I'm fortunate that I can still be anonymous. In other words, I can go where I want, and very, very seldom do people come up and say, "Hey, you're Kenneth Anger," and bother me. And I enjoy that, enjoy my anonymity. But I do have my followers who come to see my films and so forth. I like that too.
What are some of the questions that people ask most at your screenings when they see you?
Well, the people are curious about my connection with Aleister Crowley, and he's one of the most misunderstood figures in our time because he wasn't a black magician. He was a philosopher, and his works are reflected in my work.
So people want to know about Crowley?
Yes, just like Lucifer Rising is based on one of his poems called Hymn to Lucifer.
Would you want to do a reading of the poem?
Hymn to Lucifer is... The last line is "The key of joy is disobedience," which sums up... It makes Lucifer the patron saint of rebels.
Yeah, you see, I guess that's what I meant before about someone like Crowley attracting crazy people, because disobedience can mean being naughty, and disobedience, depending on how you interpret it right, can mean killing someone. So what does that mean to you, disobedience?
Well, Crowley believed you had to find your true will, and if you find your true will, you won't go around killing people.
So it means disobedience to you in the sense of like not following rote structures or questioning things and then finding your own way of doing it?
Crowley thought you should not follow leaders. You should question. You should make up your own mind about things.
Does it ever put you in an awkward position being a director, which is being in a position of leadership when you're making a movie? And my friends who make movies tell me it's very difficult to maintain relationships as the movie goes on.
Well, it's particularly... difficult, of course, because I can't use the means that Hollywood has to keep people in line, which is contracts and,
right.
and big salaries. But I've been fortunate that I found people who like working with me and have stuck it out through the film, which is often quite difficult.
What are some of the things that you really love most about Hollywood and Hollywood imagery?
Well, the possibility of creating a completely make-believe environment and world is wonderful. I mean, the studios have that possibility. I mean, the craftsmanship of creating, say, a scene out of medieval times or the future, something like that. And special effects. I have some special effects in my film, but they're mostly handmade. And of course, a lot of things, there's a lot of things that can be created in an almost handmade way, which Hollywood has become so inflated and pompous that they don't see the simple way often of doing some things. Also, the way of suggesting things by inference.
I'd figure that you also really love some of the costumes that one can afford when you have budgets like that.
Yeah, I look wistfully at the kind of things they can do.
What kind of things do you collect?
Well, I have a collection primarily of the silent period of films. I mean, that's my main collection. And it started when I was a child. My grandmother was a costume mistress for United Artists, and she gave me some costumes that belonged to Rudolph Valentino. She also gave me dresses of Clara Bow and Pola Negri, several mm-hmm. of the big stars of the silent period. And I have a traveling exhibit on Rudolph Valentino, which has been to the Chicago Art Institute and the Berlin Film Festival. And I may show it somewhere else again.
Well, when I think of costumes, I also think of your film Puce Moment.
Yes, that was using some of the costumes that belonged to my grandmother in that film.
Can you describe the film?
Well, it's a fragment of a longer film that was to be called Puce Women on the 1920s in Hollywood, which would have an all-woman cast and show various types of women of that period in the costumes of the period, from everything from the sort of ingenue flapper to the very sultry vamp. And I just made a fragment of that, which is Puce Moment, I call it.
Who's in it?
A lady named Yvonne Marquis that later went on to become mistress to the president of Mexico. So that's her claim to fame.
I wonder if he knows about the movie.
I don't know.
But the movie seemed to be a little bit about how, you know, the transformation of putting on a costume like that,
yes.
The transformation you undergo when you're in it.
Right. Well, that's a recurring theme in my films. Sort of clothes have the power to transform, at least for the length of time that they're worn.
Well, the two times I've seen you, which is now when you're wearing an orange, subdued orange shirt and a suit.
I guess so, yeah.
And I think you had a Lucifer Rising t-shirt on when I saw you at the Whitney, I think, and a pair of jeans. But so what kind of clothes do you wear, given the understanding that you have of costume and your understanding?
Well, I don't wear costumes in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
I like occasionally to dress up for a carnival, something like that.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite epic films?
Epics, I like some of the big Cecil B. DeMille things, and he had a sense of overdoing things that I rather liked.
Yeah.
And the earlier films, I liked better to his later films. I mean, things like Sign of the Cross or Cleopatra, I think, are great. Of Cecil B. DeMille's films.
Do you have any favorite Teenage Rebellion movies?
I like Rebel Without a Cause. I was quite a good friend of Nick Ray, the director, and I think it holds up quite well.
Mm-hmm. Favorite directors?
I like Murnau, Eisenstein, and Nick Ray. That's three directors I like very much.
This is a funny question, since you're so interested in silent movies, but do you like musical comedies, film musical comedies?
I love Busby Berkeley films. And I have one of the original neon violins that was used in Gold Diggers of 1933. In Gold Diggers of 1933, one of the musical numbers is called The Shadow Waltz, in which 60 of Busby Berkeley beauties are shown waltzing around with violins. Then the lights go out and they turn into neon outlined violins, and they're playing on those.
That's great. More excess.
Uh-huh.
What about actors and actresses? Some of your favorites?
I like Garbo, and I like Clara Bow. And among more recent people, I like some of the things that Jack Nicholson's done. And a lot of silent actors and actresses.
Amongst the people who are in Hollywood Babylon, who are still living now, what kind of response did you get to the stories, the scandals that you told about them in your book?
Well, the only really abrasive response I had was from Gloria Swanson. And she is the only star who thought badly enough of what I did to try to sue me, but she didn't succeed, because the judge threw the case out of court and said the case has no merit, because she may have forgotten, she is 82 now, that when she called Lana Turner a tramp, which seems very trivial, but she did in print, it was in Walter Winchell's column, and I had the column to back it up. And so once the judge saw a photostat of Walter Winchell's column, he said this case has no merit, so Miss Swanson had to back down.
What was so interesting about finding people with other makeup on and finding stories that might not have been known, scandalous stories, people at their worst, basically, at their most degraded or desperate?
Well, I don't call them degraded, just being human.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because the idea of Hollywood stars was traditionally... I mean, now they're much more accessible as human beings, but in the early days, it really was putting people on a pedestal, and they were like gods and goddesses, which, of course, they weren't. And they were deliberately kept rather inaccessible. Now, you have pictures of them in their kitchens or gardens. You know, it's much more casual. But the studio encouraged this way of treating stars like royalty in the old days. And so whenever one did get out of line and be involved in a scandal of some sort, it always seemed much worse at the time. And of course, morals have changed, because what was considered shocking in 1920 is no longer considered at all shocking today. Today we have a president who was divorced from a Hollywood actress. In 1920, when Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks divorced their respective spouses so they could marry each other, this was considered very shocking. It's just the idea of divorce was at one time considered very shocking.
The recent big scandal that could have ruined a career, but it looks like it didn't, was Roman Polanski, who had to leave the country.
He's still directing films in Europe.
Right.
I do think that he's been a little bit tarnished around the edges, but he still has talent.
Mm-hmm. You're working on a couple of other Babylon follow-ups, aren't you?
Yes, a sequel to Hollywood Babylon, which I call the slightly tongue-in-cheek title Son of Hollywood Babylon, which will bring Hollywood stories up to date. And then I have another book in the works, which is Washington Babylon, which is a history of the scandals which have periodically rocked Washington, back to Harding and even back to George Washington growing cannabis at Mount Vernon.
You're going to have to protect yourself, aren't you?
Well, I suppose so. Again, it's like I'm not printing hearsay. I mean, it's facts which have been pretty much verified.
What do you think of things like the National Enquirer, which try to get people looking really ugly on the cover? Or I'm talking about the star-related, not the I Ate My Daughter stories, but the star-related scandals, which are frequently untrue.
Well, if they're untrue, they risk being sued, and I think they have been sued.
They've been sued a lot of times.
A lot of times.
They've got a lot of them pending
right
now.
That's irresponsible journalism. But
why do you think so many people want to hear it? Because certainly the magazine sells really well. The newspaper, tabloid, that's the word.
Well, people have a very odd relationship to celebrities. It's a kind of a love-hate. They actually have helped create them. In other words, so they feel a proprietary interest. They're like, they own a piece of these people. It's a very odd attitude, but it is an ambivalent attitude. It's like an idol can be toppled and devoured or destroyed. And this has happened over and over again.
Have you ever had any idols?
I idolize Rudolph Valentino. I have since I was a child, and I idolize Clara Bow. Of course, I didn't know either one, but I admire them.
Mm-hmm. Now you have a lot of their stuff in your collection, I guess.
I have, yes, a very large collection of photographs, posters, and memorabilia on both of them.
What were your ambitions when you were a teenager? What did you think your future life was going to hold, and what did you most want to do?
Well, I'm doing right now what I wanted to do then, and I began doing then, which is making my own movies. I'm my own boss, and even though I haven't made as many films as I wish I could have, I'm still in complete control of what I do.
A lot of people have written about your films for film journals. There's been, you know, scholastic articles, very academic articles written about you. What has made the most sense, and what has struck you as being, you know, the most ridiculous of the things that have been said about your movies?
Well, as far as what has been good, I've had a marvelous insight into my film in the it's called the Atlanta Art Papers. That's been an excellent piece. And some of the more like academic things I can do without.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you had the money at your disposal that, you know, a major motion picture has, and the technology at your disposal, what kind of films do you think you'd be doing?
I'd love to do some large-scale fantasy films. I don't think I ever will. So I'm not really like pining away because I can't. But I've certainly dreamed about them. And an example is I'd love to do the some of Abraham Merritt's work. Abraham Merritt is a pioneer science fiction writer, fantasy writer, who worked in the teens and 20s. And he wrote something called The Ship of Ishtar, which I think would make a magnificent fantasy. On 70 millimeter, naturally.
Right.
And with at least a $36 million, the same budget as Heaven's Gate or something, something like that.
You use the word dreaming. That reminded me. Some of your movies seem to be dreamlike in the connections that they make, the non-linear connections that they make. Are your dreams ever material for your movies?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes, the closest I've ever done to filming a dream was my teenage film that I made when I was 17, Fireworks. That was very close to an actual dream I had. And it's considered as sort of a classic example of a dream on film. And it's been bought by the Carl Jung Institute in Switzerland.
No kidding.
Among other places.
And they're analyzing it, huh?
Uh-huh. Well, it's just part of their collection.
Uh-huh. Kenneth Anger, it's really been so interesting to talk with you. I really thank you for coming and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. The Fresh Air is very pleasurable.
Thanks. Kenneth Anger is a filmmaker and a writer. His most recent book is called Hollywood Babylon, and there's a couple of follow-ups to that in the works. And some of his films will be shown tomorrow night at the Moore College of Art, and they include Scorpio Rising and Lucifer Rising.